Hello and welcome back to me. Yay. It's Emma. I'm back to take control.
Boo. Yay! Thank God.
Yeah, good.
We like Len.
Thanks, guys. Now that I'm back in the land of the internet once again, hurrah! I'm delighted to have the full Lovecraft Country Critical Gang with me today, starting with the lovely Lucy.
Hello.
Gareth.
Hello.
And Len.
Hello.
Team thing.
Team Everybody is here to discuss episode 8, Sugar Bobo, which I'm very much looking forward to talking about. So now that I'm back to take control, we will be going to our usual structure of the podcast, starting with our overall thoughts on the episode and our blueberry scores, which I will explain very succinctly shortly, followed by a deep dive into the plot before we trot on over to Cthulhu Corner, possibly even some Lovecraft Lounge and listener feedback before we say our goodbyes. So first up, I want to get everybody's very to the point overall thoughts of episode 8 and your blueberry score. And the blueberry system is thus. It is a scale of 0 to 5. 0 is the worst, 5 is the best, and there can be no halves. Len, hit me with your thoughts.
Oh, I wasn't expecting you to get to me first, but here we go. I really enjoyed the episode. Look, I think the show's on a pretty good run since episode 6, where they sort of had that palate cleanser of an episode over in Korea. And I think this is the best episode where we sort of focused on the main storyline, you know? Because if you take last week sort of away and episode 6 away, because I feel they're their own sort of thing, I kind of think that this episode, which encompasses so many different elements of the main storyline, was the most exciting. It was the most horrific of the season. I also think, Dee was amazing in this episode. Like, there's so many standout performances in singular episodes this season, and Dee's just added her name into the hat, as it were. For that, because I thought she was really great. It had that sort of Jordan Peele horror, the sort of stuff that we've seen in his second horror film, Us. But it centres around the real horror, obviously the horrific murder of Emmett Till, or Bobo, which we've discussed the references in earlier episodes. And to see it, even though we didn't see it, if you get what I mean, in this episode, was very powerful. And then just other than that, like the character stuff between Montrose and Tick, Letty and Tick, and Ruby and Christina / William / Wiltina / whatever you want to call them, I thought was very good. I thought there was loads of good stuff in here, lots to unpack. So I'm excited to talk about some of it with you guys and see what you think. But for me, it's a 4 blueberry episode.
Nice. Thank you, Len. And very succinct and to the point. How unusual and delightful. Lucy, over to you. What were your thoughts on episode 8?
Scary. Busy.
Good.
I thought that was it. I thought that was the
buzzwords. Just buzzwords.
Confusing at times. Powerful. 4 bloobs. There you go. Now there's your succinct to the point.
Mate, that is spot on. Absolutely spot on.
Yes.
You've nailed it.
Why are you trying to one-up me?
Not hard.
Gaz, can you do any better?
I like this episode.
The end.
I mean, some of the D scenes are going to haunt me forever, I think. And I'm looking forward to talking about them a bit more. I think I'll treat that as a bit of therapy.
Group therapy.
I think the horror was the best horror that that we've seen, personally. I think it was very Jordan Peele-esque. I think that's absolutely spot on. But in addition to that, there were some really good sort of character moments in terms of some of the conversations that were happening. The one between Wilstina and Ruby, really good conversation. Tick and Montrose got some of their development with some quality dialogue. But then some parts of the episode were on the unnecessary side. There's a very meta book situation that I'm sure we'll discuss. There's the scene with Christina at the end, again, you know, without going into details, I just found it unnecessary, and it's a thing that this show does. It falls into the trap of being gratuitous or ultra-violent unnecessarily, in my opinion. But overall, really good episode. I'm going to give it 4 blueberries.
Thank you very much. 4 across the board. Interesting. I obviously haven't been here for a couple of weeks, and I think taking a step back has been really good for me with this show. A lot of this really hit me in the feels. You mentioned a few things there, Gaz, like Will, Tina and Ruby, Montrose and Tick. But this episode also scared the absolute shit out of me, and I am 100% never going to sleep again. Ever. Ever again. And for both of those things, I think this is the best episode of the season, and I'm giving it 5 bloobs.
She's back. Ooh. A crazy score.
She's back.
Let that sink in, team. Let that sink in.
Interesting. Yeah, I think it is a good episode. It is a good episode.
Yeah.
Five is not a mad score at all. I think it's good. I think it's a very good episode. So I respect your decision, Emma. I respect
it. Don't worry, Emma. Len agrees with you and is allowing you to have that
Thank
score.
Thank God.
So that's
Thank
fine.
The Lord.
I won't edit you out. I won't Don't, edit you
no,
out. That's how
you
nice
can't
I am
edit
today.
Me out. I'm the bloody host.
Be a bizarre podcast.
Just no Emma. Nothing. No, I mean, 4's a good scores, and I think for me, just having seen the last, I watched episode 6 and 7 yesterday, I watched episode 8 today, and I think watching them all on the back of each other, this then really brought everything back together for me. So yeah, excellent. But before we dive into a very, very full plot, I am going to hand over to Len for a little advert break.
Hello, yes, quick advert here at Lovecraft Country Critical. That's right, Lovecraft Country Critical. If you are listening to this podcast on that specific channel, please do subscribe. We would very much like your subscription. We hope you have enjoyed our coverage of the show so far. But to say, the show is obviously coming to an end very soon, in 2 weeks to be precise. And if you're thinking, how am I going to listen to these guys every week? After this show, it's very easy. All you have to do is search Fan Critical on any podcast app, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, you name it, we're on there. That's Fan Critical. And on that channel, we release everything that we talk about. So we've done Game of Thrones, we've covered The Walking Dead, Stranger Things, Westworld, Castle Rock, any of the Marvel movies. We've even got our own series like The Worst of Netflix. How the fuck have you not seen that? There's loads on there, so just search Fan Critical and please do subscribe to that channel to listen to the top bants that we all deliver on a weekly basis, yeah? We're here forever, guys. We've got 225 podcasts. Please do check it out, Fan Critical. And if you want to sponsor us further, please do go to patreon.com/fancritical, and on there you will see options to give us some dollary dues, some dollars monthly, and that helps towards operating costs. Don't worry, you do get things for your money. You get access to our Discord server. You get access to our caster episodes where we recast films with different actors, usually to hilarious results. And you can even commission a podcast. So that's patreon.com/fancritical. Everyone who supports us, we appreciate everything. We appreciate reviews. We appreciate subscriptions and any financial support. So thank you everyone for listening. And back to Emma in the studio.
So, we open up the episode with a very large crowd in the street, police everywhere, and we eventually zoom in on a distraught-looking Diana and a preacher talking about being angry, but, you know, fighting with the law rather than going back. And there's some interesting moments here, but essentially the sum is that we're at the funeral / wake of Emmett Till, aka Bobo. It's a very challenging open, I think. You know, there's certain things that happen here, like Diana saying, "What's that smell?" and Ruby responding, "It's the hottest day of the year." One of the things that we know about the tragic story of Emmett Till is that his mother displayed his body to show what had been done to him. So clearly, without being too grim, that's what that's all about. But Diana goes missing from the crowd and everybody splits off to find her. I mean, Gaz, what did you feel about this opening to the episode?
I thought it was a very overwhelming start. It felt like there was a lot going on. There were a lot of sounds. There was a lot of sort of confusion. I think I'm guessing that was very deliberate. I found it very disorienting to begin with. And I mean, it was interesting that at that point, all of the adult characters seem very concerned about where Dee is, and then they all almost forget, like they've got other things to get on with in this episode. And but yeah, just that sense of being overwhelmed was a bit much to start the episode.
I think for Dee, it's like it's a bit of a, she's had a very rough time of it recently, obviously losing George, her father, losing now Bobo and her mum. She knows that like Hippolyte has disappeared. Something's not right. Where is she? She's got no real parental figures to lean on. I mean, I know she has those other characters around her, but they seem very preoccupied with their own situation. Yeah. And to be honest with you, although they're saying, oh, hey, Dee shouldn't be here, whatever, they're all thinking about what else is going on. You know, Tick's just been to an alternate timeline and thinks he's going to die in 5 days. And, you know, Letty's pregnant and got that going on. Ruby's changing into a white woman every 5 minutes. And, you know, Montrose is trying to hide his homosexual relationship whilst also trying to protect his son. And it's just like, they're all saying, oh yeah, D, but internally they're actually, and the way they're acting is like, yeah, we don't have time for this, which is terrible. And it's not their fault. There's just a lot going on. And I feel sorry for Dee because she literally feels so isolated in this episode, and that comes to a head as we go through it.
Did anyone else think it was weird that they used Bananarama, Cruel Summer? Bit of a weird vibe.
Yeah.
Kind of, almost a weird vibe. Not upbeat, but a bit too upbeat. Kind of worked. But it maybe, it added to the disorienting, if that's a word, feeling that you described, Gaz.
I mean, it's a song that is kind of impossible to not sing along to. And this isn't this
not
isn't
a sing along, is it?
Singing Bananarama,
no.
Is it?
It's not a sing along, is it? No, no.
We hit the credits, and then we return to Dee, and she's wandering down the street. She's looking in the window of the amusement arcade, and the place is basically deserted. She's clearly really struggling to deal with her emotions, and there are a couple of girls that come out of the arcade laughing, and she starts throwing stones at them, which is understandable. I don't think she knows quite how to manage.
They wave at her. Why are you waving?
They've been in the arcade.
They're just stop being weird. They're eating ice cream and just giggling at
her. How do they not know what's happened?
What's going on here?
Yeah. It's pretty insensitive. Mm. I mean, the store next to the arcade is closed for Emmett, it says on the sign, which, you know, kind of tells you everything. But before we can get any further with this, that wanker, Captain Lancaster, turns up, doesn't he? And I don't know why I'm laughing about this, because it's awful. So he corners her in the alleyway and starts to interrogate her about where Hippolyta is and asking her, like, what do you know about magic? And Dee's response is like, what, you mean in, like, fantasy books? And while he's doing that, his mate's drawing some symbols on the floor. And then the floor starts to, like, vomit maggots out of the cracks in the paving. Lancaster is chanting. Then he spits. Then she can't breathe. And then they kind of leave her in the alleyway, pretty traumatised. Lucy, how do you feel about maggots?
Well, we had a bit of a maggot discussion earlier, didn't we? When people don't collect your bins, you end up with maggots. So that's that on maggots. But it was really disturbing.
Missed that
because...
bit of the chat, did I?
Yeah. Yeah, don't worry.
Quality stuff. Can we repeat it? Get it in this pod, please.
Is that a Patreon? That's a Patreon only snippet, that one. So sign up to patreon.com/fancritical.
Jesus Christ. You'll have access to our exclusive bin chat.
It's really good. It's really good chat.
No, this is a horrible bit. Maggots are bad. But it is a really creepy scene because you don't know what they're going to do, because this is the police. in the 50s with a young black girl, like, we've seen that nobody really gives a fuck about, like, in authority gives a fuck about what happened to Emmett Till. So you don't know what's going to happen. And then what they actually do is really, like, really creepy and gross. But I thought it was interesting that you said, you guys said at the beginning about no one's really listening to Dee and no one's really actually concerned about her. So it's quite ironic in a way that they do this spell so she can't talk to anyone. It's like, well, no one's really listening to her. So who's going to listen to her if she was to tell anyway?
I mean, so this was really interesting for me because I know what happens to the equivalent character in the novel, which is similar, nowhere near as fucking creepy. I mean, Len, for you, it probably would have been the same thing. How did you feel about the way they've adapted this for Dee?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is, I feel like this spell is... I mean, first of all, I don't like Captain Lancaster in the show. I think he's just weird and...
Don't like him in the book either.
I mean, he's a horrible character, but I mean, at least in the book, he's a bit more nuanced. There's a bit more to him. In this, he just seems like a fucking idiot and a horrible, horrible man. The spell stuff that they do to Horace in the book, I feel like it has more of a purpose. Like in the show, it seems like they just go, oh, we should have just killed her because that's the way it goes at the end. Whereas with Horace in the book, there's more of a long game. They're trying to essentially find out more about Hippolyta because they know she was at the observatory. She's back in the book. And, you know, so they're trying to get to his mother in the storyline. Obviously, Horace is Dee in the show. So it's a horrible scene. The spell with the restricting of actually saying anything is actually very well described in the book, and I thought they did a pretty good job of it in the show too. Mm.
Yeah, I agree. I think I actually liked it better. I mean, I hated it. It was horrific, but I liked it better than what we had in the book with Horace. Everyone's gone off to look for Diana. No one is looking in the right places. We see Letty go back to the house to look for her and find GR sitting there. But before we get into that, Tick goes off ostensibly to look for Dee. But actually what he does is he meets Christina, or Wiltina, as she will henceforth be known, in a tomb, which is not the, you know, the most creepy place to meet anyone ever, and asks her to teach him how to cast a spell. What he actually does instead of bringing her the pages is he gives her the key from the orrery.
Orrery.
I was so pleased to hear Len saying that and thinking, that's how I sound. I don't sound like an idiot. And so Christina tells him that to cast a spell, you need not only the incantation, but you need energy, intention, and a body to upset the balance of nature without a disaster. So Christina shows Tick a protection symbol and then says, right, I'm off to achieve immortality. See ya. Gaz, bit of magical stuff here. Creepy setting. How did you feel about the interaction and the speed at which, I suppose, this is moving now?
So, I feel like Lucy might agree with me here. I'm not gonna give this as a criticism of the show, but I'm finding this magical element really bamboozling. Like, I don't know what the point is. I get this sort of immortality thing, but then Christina seems to be criticizing her dad for trying to be immortal, but then she's trying to do the same thing, and I don't really remember what the orrery does and what the purpose of it is, and
time machine.
I'm a little underwhelmed with this part of the storyline. As I say, I don't necessarily mean that as a criticism of the show. It's probably a criticism of me as a viewer, and I haven't sort of focused on it properly. This was a weak part for me personally because of that. I don't know. I didn't find the tomb setting particularly. It was quite a cozy tomb.
Yeah, it's nice. It's very clean.
Lovely in there.
If ever, yeah.
Well kept.
Whenever I was going to a tomb.
No maggots
to be seen.
That's absolutely fine.
Maggot-free tomb.
But I did agree with you, Gaz. Yeah, I think the magic stuff. What annoys me, and I think you see it, it hinders so many shows, but when there's like rules and about how magic works and then a lack of rules and... It's like sometimes they're so concerned about how all these like spells and incantations work, and other times it's like it doesn't seem to matter at all. And I think that can be quite frustrating. And yeah, I agree. Like the use of magic in this, in what Christine is trying to achieve is a bit, it just seems a bit irrelevant in context of say what Ruby's doing even. Like I could get that a bit more than what Christina wants.
I think it's a bit challenging, isn't it? Because it's been a bit rushed with Christina and a bit confusing, so it's hard to know if she really knows what she wants, I think.
I mean, what does she want?
Just immortality. I mean, it's muddled. Like in the book, I think you get a grander sense of the fact that this is obviously Caleb Braithwaite, but he's acting on his own volition. But it's more, you get more of a sense of the order, like how vast it is, how far it spans, and how this greater natural philosophy, as they call it, because they don't like calling it magic in the book, and I hate it every time that the show says magic. I'm like, oh, that is lazy. stop saying that, please.
It's magic.
Yeah, it's just magic, isn't it? And I think in the book you get a better sense of that. Like you get a sense that there's a bigger world out there, and in the show obviously you get that, but because we've just got Christina / William / Wiltina as now our main focal point for the sort of magic, it kind of loses a bit of that sort of mystery to that element of the show. I think
because they've wrapped up the original natural philosophy magic storyline with the Wiltina storyline, which I like, has made, it's almost diluted it a bit, so neither part of it makes quite as much sense as it would have done if it was just one or the other.
Well, I take it back then. I do mean it as a criticism of the show.
Yeah, it is. It's valid. I validate you.
Be
guys.
Confident in your criticism.
Yes, it's not my fault.
Well, look, let's go back to Diana, who returns home to find Montrose there. Yeah, I'm sorry, Lucy, we've got to talk about it. She basically bursts out and says, you're lying to me. You know, she knows that Hippolyte is missing. If she knew about Bobo, she'd have come home. And she locks herself in the bathroom, puts on a baseball cap, turns on the radio to ignore Montrose as he starts telling her a story that sounds like it could be quite emotive. And then, obviously, a book falls off a shelf and has a creepy, horrible face on it. So when it starts sliding towards her, she escapes out the window.
The music as well. The music goes well creepy. It's like, keep knocking, let me in, let me in, let me in. Someone's knocking at your door. Does anyone else remember that song from the adverts? You're both in Australia.
Yeah, I was going to put the audio in, but I don't think I need to now. Yeah.
I hate it when that happens in... I think it's such a creepy thing to use. Like the music suddenly starts to like go against you as well. And yeah, the imagery of the book is really frightening as well. And then, yeah, because you see that, we didn't mention it, did we? But with the police officer, with Lancaster, the cream of wheat sign, the eyes move, don't they? And that's like the first sort of symbol of what's to come. And I was wondering if it was going to be like, well, the adverts are going to try and get her, but it was much worse than that.
Yeah, and I think the book here is Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is like a very famous text in terms of, some people say it sort of helped the American Civil War in a way. It was a very important piece of literature. We'll talk more about the app sort of demons that she sees later
it's
on.
It's fine. We've covered them, I think.
Okay, cool. Right, I'll stop talking.
No, I'm joking.
I'm sure as you say, we'll talk about it a little bit more as we go, but yeah, it's important to kind of recognize that this book, as you say, Len, it was credited with being a major help in the abolitionist cause when it came out. But since then, it's sort of the book has been kind of subject to like corruption, and it led to the, like I was reading up on it, it led to the popularization of a lot of pretty terrible stereotypes about black people. So I think that's kind of that's a really interesting way of dealing with that. Like the book itself is being corrupted there, and
that's very true.
Just like time corrupted it.
Well, Uncle Tom is a is like a, not a slur, but it's like a derogatory nickname now for like a black person that's kind of a stereotype that's like favourable to white people. So that was a really good use of that book.
Ruby now turns up at Will Tina's house, and some really rude dude outside is saying like, "Are you the maid?" And William turns up. There's what I thought was quite a tender look between them, which then, you know, you look at Ruby's in tears. She's having a rough time. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on. It's been a difficult day. Will Tina runs her a bath, undresses her, washes her in the tub before kissing her, which Ruby doesn't really seem to be up for, which is understandable considering the day she's had. So instead, she takes the potion, clearly wanting to be away from herself before she can be with Will Tina, and then they do the deed. And what I did think was slightly grim about this, because I really liked the two of them together, was her changing mid-coitus, which was grim but also weirdly powerful and like emotive. Like, it was visually grim.
There's a lot to talk about here, because it's like, what the fuck is going on? Like, who is telling the truth and what they're saying? Obviously grief does is a very powerful emotion. It makes people do crazy things, like the idea that she's just seen Bobo and Emmett and then gone to have sex with a white guy after seeing that is bizarre to think. Like, what is she doing? And then also to do it as a white woman, and then her excuse feels very, and I think it gets called out by Christina afterwards, saying, no, you just wanted to say you can do what the fuck you want. And that's a very challenging thing to see. It's a very challenging thing for, I guess, a lot of viewers to accept as well. And but in terms of the visceral nature of the scene and just the way it looked, wow. I mean, fucking hell. The special effects on show in this scene are out of this world good. Out of this world good. Like, that is impressive what they did here. I mean, from a technical standpoint, the scene is beautiful. It's horror that is beautiful in a way. And the use of the music as well is fantastic. I don't know, just everything about this scene was like, just, I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And for bad reasons in terms of narratively, and for very good reasons in terms of just how incredible the scene looked. So I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was a great scene.
I thought the thought of changing those bed sheets afterwards horrendous.
I have thought this like multiple times, like, you know, their transformations and how gory it is. It's like the amount of cleaning that must have to go on.
Clean up operation.
It's insane.
They're silk sheets. They're never using them again. They're gone.
They're ruined. Yeah. Carry some wet totally wipes done. With you.
Yeah, might help. Do you know what? The thing I really liked about this scene, or kind of series of scenes, and actually the whole of the Ruby Will Tina stuff, was how much I started to feel like Ruby has genuine feelings towards Will Tina, and that it was interesting to see that after what she had to deal with, you know, earlier, never mind finding D, you know, not important, person that she ran to was Will Tina. Like, that for me really made a point.
I think it goes both ways.
I thought it was really interesting.
I think that Will Tina's feelings for Ruby, it's more than just trying to get to Letty and Tick. I think there's something more there. And there are some quite confronting scenes, like you've said, between them. And when Ruby says about how tired she is of having to basically inhabit the world as a black woman, and the injustices that she has to witness.
I found that scene, I felt like she was talking to the audience, not Christina.
Yes.
To be completely honest with you, that felt to me like a very...
did it feel like she was talking to you? Like, I felt like she was talking to me.
Yeah, I felt... It was quite moving. Like, saying, I want you to feel how I feel, but I know you never can. And I was like, oh, shit, I feel like they're talking to me here. And I guess that's completely intentional. At the same time, just to talk about Christina, you know, she's getting into bed with the devil here, Ruby. I mean, I don't believe Christina for a second, to be honest with you. There may be something in there, but I think that's... I don't know. I just think that's the show trying to say, oh, she might like her. But I honestly think she's a very ooh, sort of
will
like,
they, won't they?
Selfish character.
Well, you don't know. She might like her.
That's what I'm getting from this. Like don't know about that.
Do you know what? Why don't we talk about that scene actually now? I know it's sort of jumping around the plot, but it feels like the right moment. So Ruby comes out and Will Tina's now Christina. She got that blood out pretty quick.
Flawless.
And she looks amazing, like genuinely amazing. Wow. Her wardrobe in this show is stunning. Anyway, so Ruby starts telling her about like what happened to Bobo. Christina says she knows, and she knows everything. She knows the names. She knows what's happened. And she essentially, you know, Ruby says, well, do you even care? And she essentially says, no, I don't. And what the things like, so Lucy, you mentioned this, Ruby starts to say, I want you to feel what I feel. You feel heartbroken, scared, furious, tired, alone and shameful because you'll never understand. And she wants her to feel guilt. And I felt that so hard as a viewer of this show. I felt like, you know, and you're right. And even the styling of the shot. So you had Ruby talking to Christina and all we could see was the back of Christina's head. And it felt like she was just saying it to every single viewer in front of who's watching the show.
It was a very powerful performance. And I think it's true. Like if you think every couple of weeks, there's a news of another brutal murder of, you know, a black person in America, usually by the hands of the police. And I'm sure we all feel like horrified by it, but then it passes and then you have the next one. But to be like a black person in America or anywhere, I guess, it must just be so tiring. Like you're constantly confronted with sort of the evidence of your place in the world like that. And it was a really powerful moment. I didn't feel like I was being preached to, because it did fit in with the show. And I remember, like, this is what I was saying about Christina's privilege, and we got a bit of feedback that kind of didn't agree with me when I had said that. But I think this kind of is evidence of that, you know. Ruby's going through all of this and she says it to another woman and she's like, oh, I don't care. And she can also use her privilege to turn into a man. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I was talking about when I said about how Christina's privilege means I don't feel sorry for her.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, Lucy. Actually, you know, I say that from a white woman's perspective, but I do. I think you're right. And, you know, one of the things that Christina says is that, like, I don't care. I don't think you care either, really. I think actually you just wanted to hide from the fact that you are a woman who wants what she wants. Well, let's move on to something that none of us like, shall we? So slight bit of jumping around in the plot here. Listeners, don't worry, I have not missed anything. We will come back to it. So Diana is out around town. She's at a subway station, train station, and it's a bit crowded on the platform. And she can see some kid dancing backwards up the stairs to the platform, which, you know, seems totally normal. No one's reacting.
It's not acceptable, actually.
It turns out to be some hideous devil child and her mate dancing absolutely horrific. And throughout this whole scene, all I kept thinking is, nobody can see them, but we fucking can. I'm never going to get that out of my head. This was utterly terrifying.
Like, I think this scene in particular, the train station one, is going to live with me.
Yeah, this is the worst one.
Forever.
The worst one. I feel a bit sick.
It's the backwards bit.
Yeah.
Every single part of it is... the backwards bit is terrifying, yes, but let's not minimise the impact of her popping out from behind her mate with a terrifying...
Or just bending over backwards.
Or bending over backwards
and the dancing the sound, and the nails.
The sound design there is unbelievable. It's so good. There's a noise that's made when the second one bends over backwards, and the noise just sort of goes like, and that sound, it's like I don't know what it does, but it's like, it just sounds like something's gone wrong. And
it's just,
that is exactly
it's,
right.
It's like, been this made is very wrong. By someone who understands horror and who understands how to get under your skin, because I can't really explain why this was so affecting and so horrific. Obviously, everyone's scared of creepy kids, but it's something about the movement. It's something about how you can't really see, and then you're like, did I just see that? And then they slowly come in, like,
it's that kind of, there's stilted movement,
jerky,
and they're kind of in the periphery of your vision, but they're right there at the same time.
Like, did I see that? And, oh, I did see that. Oh, they're coming closer. Backwards. Oh.
And I think also the impact of everybody else not reacting, which how could you do that? You feel like D. You feel, I mean, this is part of the reason why this for me is a 5 Blueberry episode, because I will never, ever, ever forget that. It scared the absolute pants out of me.
It's very Jordan Peele. It's very... us. It's the tethered out of us, basically. It's like the sort of, you know, if you haven't seen us, go watch it and you'll get what we're talking about.
Done quite a big spoiler there. So.
But this is, yeah.
Yeah.
You say it's a spoiler, but that film goes to some weird places, man. Like, you don't know what's going on in that film.
I don't want
to. So this is, I'm doing a bit of reading. So they're basically pickaninnies, right? These sort of caricatures.
Yeah, caricatures. They've,
a sort of a racial caricature, if you get what
so
I mean.
Unpleasant but history.
Again, that idea is a corruption of the characters in Tom's Cabin. Yeah.
It's an appropriation, isn't it?
Yeah. And the description here is, I was able to find, is pickaninnies had bulging eyes, unkempt hair, red lips, and wide mouths in which they stuffed huge slices of watermelon. So, yeah, that was the description. I mean... Yeah, it's like you said, Gaz, corruption of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which he saw in the bathroom, and now is literally turned
now
into
a living
this
nightmare.
Us like tethered demon that is now chasing her.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've got some stuff in Cthulhu Corner in terms of other horror films as well, so we can talk about that later.
Also, the music again. That, Len. Scary music. Let us in. Yeah. Let me in. Let us in.
Always putting sort of old-timey music with stuff. It's like when you used to watch, you know, Insidious, and it goes, what's that bitch around the corner?
Stop. Stop. I can't do that. I can't handle. We've got to move on. I'm sorry.
Just quickly as well, the characters are credited as Topsy, and I think it's Bopsy.
Yeah.
And
Topsy and Bopsy.
Topsy is one of the characters in... Uncle Tom's Cabin. She's a slave girl, and I think from sort of trying to connect the dots from the reading that I did, I think it's that character Topsy was then sort of extrapolated and corrupted into a pickaninny sort of. That's where it came from.
Well, from two demons to another kind of demon. So Tick arrives back at Letty's house and sees a pair of shoes outside the front door, which he obviously has correctly guessed belong to GR. He comes in, this is in two scenes, but we're going to do it in one. He comes in to find her and Letty sitting at the table together in silence. And this feels ominous, let's be honest. So GR's explaining that she's Kumiho?
Kumiho.
And how that basically works, being a soul-eating, sexy, foxy demon. Tick basically just wants to know how and when he's going to die, but she doesn't really have answers. Letty is clearly particularly unhappy about this. And after she storms out, Tick tells GR that what they had wasn't real and he's not dying before storming off.
Not dying.
I mean...
So write that down. I'm not dying. Yeah?
Lucy, how did you feel about bringing sort of the story of episode 6 plus the flashback that we had into our current storyline? How did it work for you?
It did not work for me. You may remember in my 6-word review at the beginning, I said busy. This is an example of busyness. We don't need to see Gia. going, yeah, actually what it is I've got nine tails, and yeah, they go into the man, and when they climax, I can see his past, and I take his soul. Wait, why are you here? And you can't give him any information about how he dies. Literally, why are you here? You've travelled from South Korea. How did you get out? Like, it is unnecessary.
I felt this is the weakest part of the episode. It was underwhelming. GR's return was just underwhelming. And I think that's a shame, because I know she's awesome and we love that character and we absolutely raved about that episode. But I'm hoping that she obviously has a bigger role to play in the end. But I just felt this scene was a bit random. It was a bit like...
Do you feel like she was just brought in as a narrative tool to get to the fight between Letty and Tick?
Didn't need it.
For them to then reunite at the end.
That could have been done over anything.
Yeah, Montrose again.
Anything. I mean, I totally agree with Lucy and Len, but I think the reason that she's there is for future purposes. She's going to be used.
I hope so, because she is
the tails.
She is good.
Use the tails for good.
Redeem yourself.
Tails assemble. Yeah, that'd be good.
So. We move on. There's some kids playing jump rope in the street.
Why?
Yep, terrifying.
Diana. Letty seems to give no shits whatsoever about Diana.
Yep,
again. Creepy girls appear again and she finds Woody. Horrible scene. Moving on. Scene I loved. So Montrose is drinking on the street when Tick walks past. Basically all Tick says is, did you cheat on my mum? But Montrose then explains, you know, I always had desires, but I never acted on them until after she was gone. And actually, they end up having what I think is a really powerful conversation, where Montrose says, you know, he chose life over an asylum or jail or death by being openly gay. And Tick tells him that Letty's pregnant. And there we go. So he went to the future and he found a book written by George Freeman, and George Freeman is his son.
Yeah, what it is a... While I was away, all this stuff happened off screen. And this book, this is my son, actually. Yeah, I didn't mention that, did I? Yeah, the book I've been carrying around all this time, that's actually my son. And I've forgiven you for everything you've done. And let's have a conversation normally. It's again, a bit rushed.
If we could take this in two parts, and Len, you're about to do that, is the stuff between Montrose and Tick is brilliant. I mean, Len, talk about that and then we'll come back to the time travel book.
The stuff between those two is great. I am very happy that they're sort of reconciling in a way, even though we know that Montrose has done some terrible things and there's no excusing what he's done, and there's still secrets
you saying it like that?
Between them. It was good to have it's because I just feel like we have to say that he's a dick, but you know, it's good that they're sort of finally telling each other some secrets, even if it is future alternate Earth timeline book written by Sun, who now he knows he has. But the book thing, I just want to comment on the book thing, because obviously me and Emma have read the book, and when they said this, I was just like, are you... Come on, that's
taking
a bit too...
Taking the fucking piss.
It's a bit too meta for me. I mean, it's like, come on. I know what you're doing, but it's unelegant, and it's also just a bit... It's just lazy. I found it a bit lazy. I mean, yes, they highlight the changes in the book. D is a boy called Horace, correct. Christina is Caleb,
well, they've
correct.
Just stolen Cthulhu Corner.
They've stolen Cthulhu Corner. They've ruined Cthulhu Corner. I will say that, I didn't like it.
I mean...
Cheap.
Yeah, it's cheap. I don't know if it's like... I don't know if lazy is the right word, Len, because it's also... It's also pointless. I mean, I'm sure maybe it will mean something in a bit, but at the moment it feels really pointless. And it's like, hey, look how clever we are being meta. And I don't understand. There's nothing added by this. And then he's like, well, the only differences are that George survives Arden, and Dee is a boy called Horace, and Christina is also a man.
Imagine that.
Why are you doing this? Is it in the book as well?
I can tell you for free, the ending is wrong. So
I was going to say,
So the only other things we find out about the book is that, well, for a start, Tick says he jumped through and that he was shoved back through the portal by a woman with a robotic arm with the book. The other thing it says is that in the end, Christina sacrifices Tick to become immortal. And this is the narrative structure that allows Montrose to say, I will sacrifice myself with the intention of saving you and my grandson. And that's kind of, that's where it moves us on. But I agree. I think it's pointless.
All I will say is just quickly is the only way it can sort of work in my head is obviously we talked about last week being like Quantum Leap and going through different alternate Earths and stuff. And there is a part of me that does quite like the idea that we are in an alternate Earth of the show. I don't know. No. There's no. But in my head, that to me is an interesting question. But I don't think that's what they've gone for. I think that's just me trying to make something.
Do you know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of that episode of The Simpsons when like Homer 3D.
Yeah. That's not your trick, Gaz. Lucy's line.
Yeah, well, it reminds me of that episode of The Simpsons where he goes back in time and changes everything.
And order is restored.
It's the multiple worlds theory, which I like as a theory, but it's just not executed.
It's not a theory,
because
it's true,
not explained. So
it's not a theory.
Well, let's switch back to Letty. So after her fight with Tick, she goes to church. She's praying. She talks about how this magic is haunting and testing them like the devil. And she basically prays and begs God to protect Tick, not let him die. And then Wiltina turns up. They have a chat about some miracles, magic, heaven, hell. Letty gives her some negatives and they eventually strike a bargain. Letty's asked for her to make Atticus? To make Tick invulnerable. And Wiltina says no and then like smashes the mark of Cain on Letty's stomach. At which point I then wrote, I've no idea what's going on here. Clearly this becomes obvious later. Lucy, what did you think of the two of them together? Because we haven't seen them interact since Christina turned up on the doorstep and Letty was having none of it.
Serious question. How tall is Christina? Because at one point it actually was scary how much taller she was than Letty. Like it looked a bit frightening. She was like looming over
her. It didn't look normal, did it?
In the aisle. It was an all right scene. I didn't get much from it. And yeah, like the mark of Cain, I was quite like, what have you, why? It's like, can you do this? No, but I will do this. He's like, well, I didn't ask for that, did I? But it actually leads to something pretty cool, so I will allow that. But yeah, she's extremely tall. That's my takeaway.
Yeah.
Lads?
That was one of my biggest takeaways, was the height of Christina.
Scary.
Len, what were you going
to
say?
She can't give the mark of Cain to Atticus because she wants to kill Atticus, so she had to sort of spin this in a way that's like, oh, I'll protect you and your baby instead, you know, kind of thing.
That does make more sense. It just wasn't very clear. Thank you for explaining, Len.
No worries.
Unlike anybody else, we care about Diana, so let's find out where she is. She's been watching the cops, following Captain Lancaster, and now she's turned up in the office and basically gone, is my mum dead and why did you spit on my forehead, you weirdo? She has got balls of steel,
yeah,
and I love her. It. Lancaster says, like, you know, I can remove the spell if you bring me the orrery. And Diana is having none of that, so she then leaves. And there is a speech, song, something running over this. Gaz, did you look it up?
Oh, the speech.
It's from 2018, I think, yeah. Isn't it? I can't remember who it is, but it is 2018. It's a recent speech. It's the young lady talking about how black girls are forgotten.
And they should have a name.
And it's a thing that the show has done on a regular basis, which is to use these very historical speeches, moments, over important scenes. And as we've mentioned this several times, most of the time I think it's worked pretty effectively, and I thought this was good. I had no issue with this. I thought this was very empowering.
I thought this was empowering.
Mm. I thought the stand that she takes against Lancaster is very powerful, and like we said, so it's that sort of call to action that I think worked very well here for Diana, because it's the moment where she's like, fuck this, I'm going to fight back.
Fuck you,
and that's
pig.
Something that Montrose said to her earlier in the episode. He was like, they're coming for you. You don't know when they're coming for you, and you better go down swinging. And literally, yep. That's what we see at the end of this episode.
Mm. Nice. I misread this. I thought that she was going to like befriend the demon girls.
And Jesus. And they all have ice cream.
Have them come and attack Lancaster and
that would have been cool.
Then do
like, I'm sorry. If that happened as a scene, like she's like, right, come over here, stop this. This other guy's a dickhead. Let's go screw him up. I would crack
Our
up.
Our common is enemy is the white man.
Look, no, he spat on my forehead.
I thought at this point she's running away from these girls because they look terrifying. And I mean, let's be fair, they're acting terrifyingly as well. Mm. But what happens when they actually catch up to her? And I thought she was waiting in the alleyway for them to come up to her and then. Then
come
like,
on, guys! There's the real enemy.
Her. Yeah, and then they would all go and attack Captain Lancaster. But
thank God you're not writing the show. Thank God.
Well, it's like Powerpuff Girls Revenge or something.
Oh, love it!
I think it's a great idea. They could be like Power Rangers. In fact, it will combine and become like super demon.
Power Ranger.
Jesus
Christ alive! Well, while we're all having a laugh, there is one scene in the show that really did make me laugh. So Montrose and Tick, I've written here, are doing their spells. And somehow when he's like practicing reciting the spell, Montrose chooses that moment to tell Tick that he's dyslexic.
I mean, at that point, be like, right, you're off spell reading.
Yeah, yeah. At that point, you're not allowed to read this.
This is quite important.
You can turn me into anything here. And then I was already giggling at that, and then he starts saying the spell, and then at the end he says amen and crosses himself, which is not funny in itself, but for some reason that just really cracked me up and I couldn't stop laughing. It might have been hysterical laughter because I was still terrified of our two little girls, but did anyone else find that really funny?
Not as much as you, no.
No, just me.
No. I thought it was funny because he's right. Like his Lol. Admission that he's dyslexic, it's kind of like... It's like almost cover for his real admission of something he didn't know about, which is that he's homosexual. Like, I know they've obviously already covered that, but it's just that's what I kind of thought it was like a callback to.
Well, it's just me that found it hilarious then. Let's move along. Who wants to talk about Will Tina hiring two blokes to beat her up, tie some barbed wire around her neck, attach her to a wheel and throw her in a river?
I'll just say I didn't like it. Personally, I thought it was unnecessary. I thought it was. I think the show made a decision to not sort of show Emmett Till, and
which I think is good. That's a good decision, I think, because it's more powerful sometimes. Like not showing those things is something that we know about, like that most of the audience knows about, and people who watch the show know about. Yeah, go on, guys. I just want to say I thought it was a good decision up to this point to do that.
Yeah, well, and I think in doing that, what they decided to do was focus on the emotional impact of it rather than the physical nature of the crime. And then this is a decision that sort of spits in the face of that decision. I don't know. Maybe there's some subtext that... that people can interpret, given that it's a white woman who experiences the same death in inverted commas, but for me it was just really brutal and graphic and unnecessary. I could have done without it, and I don't really see what purpose it serves for Christina as a character.
If it's trying
either.
To show her. Like humanity, but I think it was kind of showing what had happened obviously to this like 14-year-old boy on the body of a white woman who had that it happened to her. There's no way that it would have gone unpunished, and whether that's what they're just trying to show, like this is what happened to him, here it is, this is exactly what happened, but this happened to a white woman who's A, not going to die, and B, had it actually happened, there's no way that the injustice that Emmett Till and his family had to endure would have happened. So, but I agree that it was pointless because is it trying to teach her empathy, or is she like, I wonder what that would have been like? Because I actually prefer her as a character if she's just cold-blooded and just doesn't care. Like, I don't actually need her to do that to get empathy. So I agree that it was a misstep. It was extremely brutal and hard to watch.
Yeah, it was very difficult to watch. And I think the problem with it is that we don't get an explanation for why she has chosen to do this. And that, I think, takes away any of the impact that might have been intended behind it. We're nearing the end of the episode now, and we've got two storylines that we follow. We've got Letty, Tick and Ruby, and then we've got Diana and Montrose. Len, which one of those should we discuss first before we discuss the other one?
I think Letty and Ruby first, and then we'll end with the mental moments, I guess. All the secrets are coming out in this episode. It feels like a cathartic release for a lot of our characters who are trying to just get everything off their chest. Like, we literally get an info dump here for each character. It's just like, oh yeah, I'm pregnant, and da 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 da, and oh yeah, I've turned into a white woman and have been sleeping with Will Tina. It's important dialogue, and I was surprised it came this early, because I felt that Ruby would have more of a purpose in terms of spying or in terms of trying to get information for Christina, but they've sort of discarded that book storyline a little bit. So it seems that basically it's just nice to have these sisters telling the truth to each other and sort of reconciling a bit more after, you know, last week's episode.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think it's nice to see them back on the same page to an extent, which is kind of like, you're pregnant? You take potions to be a white woman? What the
fuck? They're the same.
But before they can carry on that conversation, hell lets loose.
Before we get to the hell letting loose bit, I just thought it was interesting that Ruby seems disapproving of Tick. It's not something that I'd known was the thing. And then she's just sort of like, you shouldn't have gone with this man.
Is it maybe an influence from Will Tina?
Well, perhaps, yeah. Just a point of note.
No, good one. Thanks, guys. So they're called upstairs by a knock at the door. Police have turned up. Captain Lancaster says they've had a tip about Nation of Islam congregating
Pesky
in there
Nation
to talk about revenge for Emmett Till's murder. One of the cops comes in. Lancaster can't because of the protection spell. So instead they leave and start shooting through the fucking doors and windows at everyone. Mental. But the episode culminates, you know, at the end with Tick turning up. As they're firing a bullet towards him, the ground in front of him erupts with a big old monster. Basically, it does
Loved
this
it.
Weird, like, giggly scream and kills all of the policemen, which is absolutely incredible. Lucy, did you like the monster too?
I did like the monster, but I did want... It's a stupid question to ask with regards to the police in the 50s there. But he says, put your hands up. So he does, and he goes, waits a few seconds and shoots him. It's like, well, he's done what you said. I know that's a stupid thing to say because the police do what they want, but it's dumb.
No, fair enough.
But yeah, the Shoggoth or whatever it was really cool. I like that it was black because it looked like Black Panther a bit. Just sort of cool monster going around, killing the racists. It's my kind of monster. And then he stopped it and like patted its little head like, good boy.
Come here, boy. Come here, lad.
Well done.
Come here, Jon Snow on him.
It's quite powerful. It's quite a powerful scene because, like you said, Lucy, it's that moment where he's been told to put his hands up, and Letty, the realization in Letty's face that he's dead, like it's like he's done everything that he's been.
And we
told
don't know
to
what's
do,
coming.
That like, he's going
that's
to die.
Unexpected.
No, but Letty thinks this is it. Letty thinks this is it. Yeah. He's dead. Like there's nothing.
The prophecy
no
is
way
true.
Tick's getting out of this. Yeah. And then for obviously the spell to have worked and to summon the Shoggoth. And then for it to go on this awesome killing rampage, which I fucking loved. I've got a question because I was only able to watch the episode once. Did Lancaster dies here, right?
I felt like his arm got chopped off.
Yeah, I think so.
But I want to find out more about
his
arm, black body.
No, we know that if you get bitten by a Shoggoth and you stay alive, we know that you turn into a Shoggoth.
I think he's dead because I'm pretty sure he was the body that went flying over to them while they were
good.
being baffled.
So that's, I guess that's interesting in terms of the way the show's going to go, because in the book, the culmination of the show is Caleb Braithwaite versus Lancaster, and sort of our supporting characters are trying to be used as pawns in this plan, and then they sort of subvert that and win the day. So the fact that they've got rid of the big bad, and I'm doing that in quote marks because I don't know who the big bad is in this show really, is interesting for the for the final two episodes is interesting to me that they've done that. So we'll see what they go with.
Well, let's talk about the last bit, which I think is probably one of my favourite bits of this episode as a whole. So Diana has locked herself in Elle's garage to protect herself. And she's drawing pictures of the creepy girls, Topsy and Bopsy. Is that what they're called? And they turn up like creepy dolls from hell. So what does Diana do? She hits them bitches round the head.
Yep.
With a massive metal pole. I was buzzing at this. And then Montrose turns up. So she seems to be holding them off. As he grabs a hold of her, the two demon girls somehow manage to start wounding her because she's not fighting them off and she's bleeding. Like, Gaz, what do you think is happening here? I mean, considering earlier we talked about Power Rangers, let's, you know, carry on with that.
Can I, we don't have like a theory corner here. I mean, we've got Lovecraft Lounge, but we don't have any theory corner that we normally have with shows. Got a theory for you. At the end, obviously, her arm is being decimated from the looks of things.
Robot arm!
Earlier, we were told that when Tick went into the future, he was given this book by a woman in a hood with a robot arm and then pushed back through the portal.
It's Diana. Gaz, that's amazing.
Interesting. I mean, that's interesting. I like it, but I don't think it's right. I think
she
the
is
robot
a Power
arm
Ranger.
Is what the is the character they're calling Beyonce, is who they call her, Beyonce from Hippolytus episode. But yeah, interesting take. I like it, but unfortunately, I think it's not that clever.
You're
Gaz,
wrong.
But,
is what Lynn's saying, Gaz? I'm afraid
you're wrong.
On your theory.
I like
Gareth,
it.
I think you're wrong, Lynn. It's I have to admit, I didn't come up with it. I found it, but
I love it anyway.
I can't remember.
First I've heard of it, so
I can't credit them.
Yeah, I will credit you, Gaz.
Yeah, I mean, Lynn, why else specifically is it? That is it. Her arm that's being torn to bits rather than the rest of it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. It's weird. I think it's just an area they can hurt her in where they're not killing her. If you know what I mean, because she's going to be saved next week. I'm pretty sure Christina is going to be involved with that, or the saving of Diana. Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be interesting, but
It's Captain Lancaster because he lost his arm. So maybe he's the woman in the hood.
Mm. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, who knows?
The bookseller.
Well, that is where we leave the episode. So unless anybody has anything pertinent to throw into the group, then I might just throw the reins over to Len for Cthulhu Corner, bit of Lovecraft Lounge and listener feedback.
Throw them.
Let's go. Hello and welcome back. Yes, I'm here for Cthulhu Corner. And yes, all hail Cthulhu. Yes, I am here. Gareth is now just deposed from Cthulhu Corner after last week's terrible showing. And I'm back, you know, so don't worry about it. Okay, first up, I thought we'd talk about... we've got a couple of things to discuss. And mainly I want to talk in this week about the horror references in this episode because this is the most horrific episode. And I want to talk about some of the horror films in which this storyline with Diana is pulling on. Now, we've already talked about Jordan Peele, who is actively involved in the show. And, you know, from Get Out to Us. And if you haven't seen Us, I do implore you to go watch it. It is an interesting horror film, which got critically very mixed reviews. But I actually really enjoyed it. And that involves the character of the Tethered, and it's this sort of idea that there is an alternate version of you that is has been sort of persecuted and is evil in a way, or what we construe to be evil. And that is definitely something that we're getting with these Topsy and Bopsy. Is that what we're calling them? Is that what you said, Gareth? Topsy and Bopsy? Topsy and Bopsy. That's what we're getting with Topsy and Bopsy. Another brilliant horror film, and this is just some recommendations from me as well. If you want to go, I love horror, so if you know you like your horror films, go watch some of these horror films. Is It Follows. Now,
scary.
It Follows is a absolutely incredible horror film. I'm going to just say the pitch to you right now, and I'll tell you how it relates to this story. The pitch of the film is basically a sexually transmitted disease. But instead of like it actually being a disease, if you have sex with the person who is haunted by this monster, that monster then chases you. And this monster it never runs. It never sort of jumps or anything. It just walks at a very steady pace. It can be anyone or anything. It can be a loved one. It can be something you're scared of. It changes its appearance and it can just follow you. And when it catches up to you, it kills you, obviously. And then it goes on to the next person before you that it slept with. So the idea is to create this chain of people. Now, the way it relates to this episode is just because it was very reminiscent to me of the way these girls were just consistently moving in the same manner, you know, doing this weird dancing, twitching thing, and moving towards the character, sometimes in the back of frame. And in that film, the use of framing and the use of this, like sometimes there'll just be a long scene of a character talking, and in the background, you just see this person getting closer and closer and closer, and it's terrifying. So if you want to watch a truly harrowing horror film, I would say go watch It Follows. It's a very good one. A couple other references, obviously The Shining. We know lots about Stephen King here. Twins, you know, terrifying. I want to talk a little bit about Nightmare on Elm Street as well, because that's a heavy influence here. The jump rope scene is 100% lifted from Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, one, two, there's, you know, someone's coming for you. Yeah. Three, four, there's a knock on the door, going back to the song, all that sort of jazz. So
five, six, you're all dead.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you haven't seen Nightmare on Elm Street, definitely go watch that. It's a hilarious horror film. You know, I'm sure you guys might find it all scary because you sound very sensitive to horror things. The rest of the members of the podcast I'm talking about.
But, I live alone. Of course I'm terrified.
Yeah, it was a scary, right? Horror film. At the time, it was scary.
No,
I guess,
I'm talking about the show.
Let's face it.
The show was scary.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, I felt it was...
Oh, yeah, Nightmare on Elm Street's hilarious.
I wasn't scared of the show, to be honest with you. I thought it was the most horror.
Len, you're so brave.
I wasn't scared of it, but...
You're just...
I know, I'm very brave. That's what I want people to take away from this, is how brave I am. And that's it for horror references. But I wanted to talk about the book. And in the book, so difference here is obviously we're talking about Horace. And now everyone knows that it's Horace because of the meta conversation that we had. But in the book, Horace is chased by a devil doll, right, Emma? The devil doll. A tiny
but
sort
of... It also has the face of the guy from... a particular food or
the
paint
store.
Advert or something, doesn't it?
Like yeah. And basically, it's this tiny little doll that's sort of been brought to life that only she can see. And it sounds pretty terrifying, but it's kind of comical horror again, because...
It's like the kid from Pet Sematary.
Yeah, but even smaller. Like, we're talking like...
Yeah, but it's like that kind of...
It's like a little doll, you know. And the way I could describe it is, I thought we were going to get this because in the fourth episode of the show, when we were in the Braithwaite exhibit in the museum, there were a couple of these like devil doll type figurines in the exhibit when they did that sort of Raiders of the Lost Ark episode. And I was like, oh yeah, there's the devil doll, we're going to get that. And I guess now it's just an Easter egg for us book readers, but I thought it was interesting. I actually think the way they went is better in the show. I think the doll would have been comical. Like, because, you know, if anyone's seen some B-movie stuff with little devil dolls running around, it always ends up as comical. So this is a way more horrific sort of interpretation of the book. And that's it for Cthulhu Corner this week. But now, of course, we move on to listener feedback. We don't have a jingle for that, so just make one up in your heads. But
welcome to listener feedback. We're going to hear from you.
Knocking on your door.
Feedback. Okay. Knocking on your door. Got some feedback for you. Okay, right. First up, we have an email from Kat. Kat Salamons. Salamons. Kat Salamons. That's how you say it. Hi, I love the podcast, and I just wanted to email in about the latest episode, I Am. This is some of this feedback. We'll be talking about older episodes.
How does she type with a little pause?
Good question. and how fantastic I thought that episode was. My mouth was actually agape during the Hippolyta scenes. I'm going with my interpretation of her name again. Once I ate some weed chocolate, and I was lying in bed... And then, whoosh, I was up there in the stars and I could go anywhere and do anything. And I had a choice to do that or go back to my life. Well, because I have two awesome kids and a wife, I chose to go back. I've had bad depression throughout my life and often felt like I had no choices. So this felt very powerful, like it was really my choice. The episode with what happens to Hippolyta really resonated with me. It was awesome. Thanks for making a great podcast.
Thanks.
Kat from the Netherlands.
Oh, thanks for listening.
Kat from the Netherlands.
And do you know what?
So, lovely. Lovely.
I didn't get to speak about that episode. Bang on. I think that there are some parts of it that you can take definitely to be like, I can feel empowered by this.
Yes. Mm.
Good for you. Also, stop eating weed chocolate.
I want some weed chocolate.
Keep doing it because it's hilarious.
Sounds delicious.
It sounds excellent. Mm.
Send
you
some
for
in.
Recommendation.
Don't really.
Next, God, can you imagine? Get that through customs. Next up, we have an email from Dan. Hello, I recently found your podcast after searching for a forum for intelligent discussion about Lovecraft Country, and I was not disappointed. Good. Don't worry. I like that each of you have different interpretations of the episodes. This provides me a deeper appreciation of the show than listening to a single critic's opinion. It may seem like old hat by the time you finish with Lovecraft, but I would love it if you would cover HBO's Raised by Wolves. It's another show that I find myself thinking about for days after each episode. I'm sure I'm not the first to suggest this. Regardless, you have a new loyal listener in me, and I look forward to all your future podcasts. Sincerely, Dan.
Thanks,
from
Dan.
Coquitlam, British Columbia, Canada. Gareth, Coquitlam?
You've heard of Canada, haven't you?
You've heard of Canada?
Well, I know Canada. Well, obviously, you know, over on the West Coast, it sounds beautiful, but I haven't heard of the specific town.
Mm, there you go. Thank you very much, Dan. Next up is an email from Kristen. Love the podcast, guys. I just wanted to comment that I assumed Tick... Oh, wait. We didn't answer that thing from Dan. I would say that... covering Raised by Wolves is something that we did discuss after the fact. And the thing is, we kind of have to plan these things in, I'd say, months in advance. We decided we were covering Lovecraft Country probably January, something like that. I have to say, Raised by Wolves is a fantastic show. And unfortunately, we just don't have time to cover it at the moment. But, you know, there's no saying that if it's a season two, then... You know, we could get involved in that. So watch this space. Next up, we have an email from Kristen. Love the podcast, guys. I just wanted to comment that I assumed Tick was in Mayfield, Missouri, which is less than a 2-hour drive from St. Louis, and also along a bus route, or it is now anyway. there are so many Mayfields in the US, so this was understandably confusing. So, Gareth, what do you think about that?
Unfortunately. No, unfortunately, it said that it was Mayfield, Kansas.
Oh, God. So,
specifically.
So Kristen, Gareth's arguing.
And it did have
now.
The coordinates.
And the coordinates. And the coordinates are on
Gareth
the
is yep. arguing He's... with the listeners. This is not good. This
means war.
No argument. Gareth's just right.
I've said it before. I'll say it again. If we lose our geography, we lose everything.
Fair enough.
I'm with you, guys. I'm with you.
Next up, we have an email from William Boggs. Hello, Fan Critical. First, though, I certainly enjoy Emma and Lucy's perspective. I want to say Len and Gaz have done a great job carrying the torch in their absence. So, Gaz...
My Len, perspective?
We did a good
job.
Sure?
You sure you mean me? Okay, fair, thanks.
Hey, he knows what he's talking about, all right?
Yeah.
Cheers, William.
I really enjoyed the podcast on episode 7. While watching the show, I was really worried that there would be a strong dislike of the episode, but was pleasantly surprised at the positive feedback it has received. I too, like you, cringed when thinking about what John would have said had he watched this episode.
You make listeners do that now. Stop thinking about
it's
John's
opinion.
It's
because Len always goes, oh, I was watching it thinking about what John would think. It's you. You keep his spirit alive by bringing him up all the time.
Yeah. Here are a couple of observations I made during the episode. I was very pleased with Hippolyta's journey as the writers let her explore all the things she has had to suppress as a female black intellect on Earth. I was especially drawn to the scene post-conversation with George, which seemed to me to indicate how far she could have gone into space had she been free to capitalise on her desires and intelligence. I do wonder what the implications of the comic page that she left behind with the murdered police officer will be. They don't seem to make many obvious call-outs without revisiting them. So yeah, obviously, just to stop the email there, we saw that this week. They know it was Diana. That's why they put the horrible spell on her.
Yeah, she signed her work. Idiot.
Yeah, idiot. I am also anxiously awaiting the backstory behind the copy of Lovecraft Country that Tick returned with. Where did he go? Is it the same novel that exists in the real world, etc.? I'm also, am I the only one who thought that it was the Book of Names before they revealed what book it actually was? Can't wait for
next
week's
podcast.
Can you imagine
if the book turned out to be written by Matt Ruff and Matt Ruff was... his son.
Mind blown.
Yeah. Oh, my son in the future is a man called Matt Ruff.
So we got the answers to that this episode. To mixed response from the team here. I think overall we weren't happy with the over meta message that they were going with. But thanks for your email, Will. Thanks for your support. Next up, we have an email from Charisse. Hello. You should all listen to the HBO Companion podcast. We've had this. Stop the email there. We do listen to that.
I'm just going to stop you there.
I started so much when I tried to say.
Why do we keep advertising this podcast?
Free advertisement for the HBO Companion podcast. No, because it is
good. They don't need it.
Charisse goes on to say, one of the show's writers is a part of it. In fact, she wrote the actual episode I Am. She states that Hippolyta does not decide to return to Earth. She decides to stay in the other world. I can understand why you think she decided to come back, as it really wasn't clear in the show. I thought she was stuck because Tick took the key and turned the machine off. Imagine that, if you just turned the machine off and left there.
I kind of like leaving the magic of making your own decisions about that, what she decided to do, if I'm honest. Just FYI.
Yeah, the other thing is, I listened to that episode, because obviously I do listen to the Companion podcast, and I thought they said she did choose to return home. So I'm a bit confused. I will say, obviously, yes, the writers are involved in the HBO Companion podcast, and that's fantastic. But as we've said before, it's very rare they ever analyze their own work in a way that is how it's being interpreted by the people who are watching it. Like, it's one thing writing the text, and it's another thing having the opinion of people who critique it and decipher it. Once that piece of art has left the page or the screen and has been viewed by someone, it becomes the people's, and they're free to interpret it the way they want. And that's what we try and do here. We try and critically examine the show. Here, fan critical. Obviously, please, people, do check out the official Companion podcast. Has obviously great insight, but if you want an honest critique of the show, stick with us, yeah? Don't worry about that, everyone. Yes. Okay. Next up, we have an email from John Foster Bay, who has written into us before and has given us some of his personal opinions on the way that race is shown in the show, etc. And I think this is an interesting email as well. Hi, guys. I'm listening to your current podcast on the I Am episode. I want to start with what I believe is an historical fallacy about Dahomey. So this is obviously in relation, Gareth, we were talking last week about the Dahomey tribe who were featured in the I Am episode. It's where Hippolyta goes. Dahomey was an African empire that gained wealth, power and prominence from the slave trade. Ironically, it was Europeans, the British, who weakened the empire by intervening to stop the Dahomey slave trade. I find it fascinating that this show would romanticize a slave trading empire because they happen to be black. This is the racist cultural nationalism that excuses all manner of crime because the perpetrators are black. For instance, If monarchy and absolute rule of kings was bad in Europe, why was it good in Africa? And like many, while I enjoyed the superhero action in Black Panther, I was not a fan of Wakanda itself, an undemocratic, pseudo-religious monarchy. This underscores for me one of the great weaknesses we suffer from. We don't know history and prefer to impose romantic narratives that are aimed at bolstering some current ideological or political agenda. We lack the knowledge and discipline to understand historical events within their own context. Another example is the assessment of Montrose's homosexuality and Atticus's response. I think it should be understood less in terms of race or current attitudes about homosexuality, but contextualized in terms of prevalent attitudes in the 1950s. Indeed, our current perspectives on homosexuality are at best 20 years old. Atticus's slur said less about him and more about the attitudes of time, and I think you got this right. Atticus was reflecting that his father's brutality was being driven not by concern for him, but by Montrose's inner demons.
Hmm.
Thoughts, hmm. team.
Yeah, really.
I mean, look, the thing is, we pick up on these references that the show is obviously trying to give us, like the Dahomey tribe, and we referenced Black Panther last week and how that was also an inspiration for a lot of the stuff in Wakanda there. I thought this was an interesting email because I just didn't know some of that information.
No, I didn't, and I think it's a good point to raise, like, is that sometimes we look at things and go, oh yeah, it's awesome because somebody of a minority or a marginalized peoples or gender or whatever it might be has done it. And actually, good point, like war and slave trade is not good. So yeah, I think it's an interesting way to raise
it. And it's
it.
Not exclusive to white
No,
people.
And it's not necessarily empowering. Although, you know, the scenes were very empowering last episode. So really interesting. I really like hearing from John. I think he's got some fantastic perspectives and he raises some really pertinent issues that probably haven't come to the forefront of my mind in the short time between watching an episode and recording a podcast.
I think it's interesting that, you know, history doesn't change, but our reading of it very much does. And the way that we see certain events changes all the time, and what the emphasis is placed upon changes all the time as well. And yeah, it could well be that you know, this the Dahomey tribe and the or Dahomey as a region and what later became the Nene, at the moment, I guess the focus from last week's episode was on the French colonization of the area, and these were people fighting for their independence and the right to rule themselves. But yeah, there's more of a history there. That's just jumping in at one point, and so you lose all the context that came before that, which I think is what John's sort of pointing out. But you know, it's impossible really to look at any historical event and consider every other bit of history that came before it, because that's a virtually infinite amount of time that you can't put that context into a snapshot of history.
And it's all cause and effect, isn't it? So how far back do you go?
Exactly.
Thank you very much for email, John. Always, as we said, a great perspective, one that we didn't have. Next up, we have an email from Tanisha. Hi all, I've been a listener since Watchmen and have been a fan ever since. If you haven't listened to our Watchmen coverage, please do go do that. And if you haven't seen Watchmen, HBO's Watchmen, go do it right now. It's a fantastic show. That's Len talking, not Tanisha. I'm sure she echoes my thoughts.
Because you sounded just like her.
Yeah. Back to the email. I absolutely enjoy when HBO does a series around books. Unfortunately for Watchmen and now Lovecraft Country, these are books that I've not read. That being said, you guys have been an awesome companion pod to listen to. I've never had the chance to write in as you produce your podcast faster than I can usually process my thoughts on an episode. But I wanted to take a moment to tell you that I think you do great work, John included. See, John still lives on, spirit of John. I also wanted to add that I'm an African-American woman living in Atlanta, Georgia, by the way of Los Angeles, California. I'm not a product of the generation highlighted on the series, but many of the stories and details mentioned I am well familiar with. It wasn't taught in school, but my parents, relatives and other elders made sure we were aware of these stories. Lastly, I know it's been mentioned many times, but I think you do a great job of approaching the subjects of race and class in the US. I simply wanted to reiterate it. Again, thank you for all your hard work. It's very much appreciated. Apologies if this was too long and it was all over the place, as I really wanted to get this out before you put out your podcast. Thanks.
Love that, Tanisha. Thank you.
No, thank you, Tanisha. That's a lovely
thank
email.
You.
No, thank you. Yeah,
we try.
No, yeah. I hope we're trying. We're definitely trying. It's. I think this show, as we discussed, has involved a lot more reading on our parts, especially, and a lot more deep diving. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. A show that, as we said before, challenges you, makes you want to learn about the world, learn about historical events, try and put those into the context of events that are happening now, etc. And I think that we're trying our best basically, and we're doing as best as we can, but we want to thank everyone who is stuck with us throughout this season. And with two more episodes to go, so I'm sure there's lots more deep diving to be done. And that's it for listener feedback. Back to Emma in the studio.
Amazing. Thank you to everyone that's written in, and thank you, Len, for bringing that all into a lovely listener feedback through Lou Corner montage. That's it from us today for episode 8, but we will be back next week for episode 9, the penultimate episode of the season, entitled Rewind 1921. And I'm going to leave you with that as I say thank you to Gareth.
Thank you.
Len.
Cheers.
And the lovely Lucy. I've been Emma, your host.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Goodbye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.